You are tuned in to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a Fireside Chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, my guest is PMH Atwater. PMH Atwater has an honorary degree, a PhD, and is one of the original researchers in the field of near-death studies, having begun her work in 1978. She has written 10 books on her findings. Her 10th, the final wrap-up of her theory about brain shift, spirit shift, straight talk about transformations of consciousness, and the future of the human race, was published in March 2011. It is this groundbreaking book just out, which is titled Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, which represent the culmination of over 3 decades of intense research with thousands of adults and children, and another decade of consciousness research. I've just read it and cannot heap enough praise on it. This is a book that truly defies gravity. It has helped me make numerous personal connections and epiphanies, and I can only say it is a must-read. So, before I take up any more time heaping praise on it, let's talk to the writer of the book now. Let's welcome PMH back to the show.
Hi.
PMH, how are you?
I'm fine.
Well, after 3 near-death experiences and 10 books, you're amazing.
Well, I'm trotting right along here, writing some more
on
a different subject.
Well,
but what we're talking about tonight is the near-death experience.
Yes, yes. And specifically, you added a lot of material in this recent book that you had kind of held back on in your previous 9 books. Isn't that right?
Yes, I held back a lot of material. You know, when you're doing research and you're dealing with physicians and scientists and PhDs and so forth, you have to be kind of careful. You can't just run out and say whatever it is you want to say and do whatever it is you want to do.
Yeah.
You sort of have to kind of mind your P's and Q's.
Right.
But with this last book on my near-death research, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, I decided, well, it's time to just open up and spill the goods. So that's what I did.
Well, I'll have to tell you, I found it spellbinding and beautifully written. I mean, I couldn't put it down. And some of the research was completely new to me that I had never really thought about, but it was there kind of right underneath the surface in many of my experiences. So I just kept connecting the dots and having epiphanies towards about the second third of the book. And so I just think this is a book that everybody would get a great deal out of. Now, in this book, you chose to have a certain number of adults and a certain number of children. Can you talk about more about who was in the research and some of the experiences they had?
Well, I didn't choose to have that many. I mean,
that's
the way it wound up.
Right.
You know, spread across 33 plus years.
So
that's just the way it happened. My research base is now nearly 4,000 adults and children. So, you know, that's just the way it happened. I'm a field worker, so I'm out there doing original work. I'm not an academic. I'm not trying to please someone with all of my papers, although I've written a few. I'm someone out there talking to the people, their families, their caregivers, their neighbors, their bosses. You know, I spent a lot of time with significant others because I wanted to see, okay, the experiencer is saying this. But how does the spouse feel, or the mom and dad, or mm-hmm. or the doctor, or the educator, or, you know, on and on and on?
Mm-hmm.
What do they notice? What do they see? So I'm always testing and retesting my material. And that's why I've written 10 books on my findings, is because I'm always going back there and saying, okay, this is true. Mm. What else is true? And mm. how far back can I go, and how deep can I dig? And, you know, how can we re-sift this mm-hmm. through perhaps mm. another lens? And mm. that's what I have been doing. And, you know, I found out a lot of things, of course, doing it
yeah.
that way.
Uh-huh.
And the book is to share that with everybody else. Let's quit beating around the bush. Let's talk about the real near-death experience, not the myth, not the one that's so popular,
right.
You know, with the general public. Let's talk about the real experience, the real after effects, and how it changes people.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some of the common misconceptions are a tunnel, and then you also said...
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, that there, most of them didn't go through a tunnel at all.
The tunnel is not that frequently reported, not
yeah.
at all.
Interesting.
In fact, mainly just in the United States, a little bit in Canada and Europe, and that's it.
Huh.
And even in those countries, it's not significant.
Mm.
So, you know, if you go back to when the media was sensationalizing Raymond Moody's first book,
mm-hmm.
that's what did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was after that that you heard more about a tunnel.
Yeah.
In the original Gallup poll survey done in 1982, only 9% of the people reported one.
Mm-hmm.
And in many parts of the world, you never hear it at all. So it's really not that significant.
Mm-hmm.
The what's significant, those aspects or components that occur the most often, is the out-of-body experience. And
mm-hmm.
those are tremendously intense, detailed, with a lot of information. Of course, some of them are simple. Most of them are very involved.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I would say that light, you know, that's the most frequently reported.
Mm.
Experiencers define that light or describe it as brighter than a million suns, but a light that's alive, knows your name, knows all about you, and can converse with you.
Yeah, yeah.
An intelligent light. And then after that, I would say a greeter of some kind. And you're just as apt to have a greeter who's an animal. We get a lot of animals. Sometimes pets that have died and gone on before the individual. Sometimes animals they've never seen before, never met before, that sort of act as guides or comforters.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you get a lot of the deceased loved ones. You get sometimes religious figures. You get a lot of light beings. Sometimes an adult will call them angels. A child, however, especially if it's a young child or a toddler, they won't use the word angel. They use the word something like bright ones or the people. You know, a lot of kids just simply call them the people.
Mm.
So, you know, and that's just sort of, if you'll pardon the phrase, the frosting on the cake. That is to say, just the surface of the near-death phenomenon, and it truly isn't a phenomenon, just not just an experience,
mm-hmm.
because it's the experience plus the after effects, and the after effects are just as physiological as they are psychological.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking mm-hmm. about something that's very impactful, as you know, Lance, as you were reading in the book, by golly, it changes brain structure,
yeah.
brain function,
Yeah.
It changes your nervous system, your digestive system, skin sensitivity.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't clue into that. They think, well, you know, you're no longer afraid of death, and you become kinder and more spiritual and more generous and more loving. Well, yeah, for the most part, that's true.
Uh-huh.
But you're also dealing with these tremendous physical changes.
Well, now, what do you think are the most significant changes that occur, and do those include things with the body as well as the metaphysical, like psychic abilities and future recall and things like that?
Well, I wouldn't call it future recall as much as I would call it future memory. A lot of people come back remembering the future.
Right.
So it's a very different, you know, it's not like deja vu. Deja vu is where you remember the past.
Right.
This is the future. And they remember having lived it and in detail. So it's a little bit different. And I wrote a book called Future Memory to really dig deep into that because it's so peculiar. A lot of people call it, well, fast forwards or... you know, or clairvoyance. No. You know, if you really look at it, it's not that. And so I really dug deep and you know, wrote the book Future Memory. Fortunately, I'm going to be able to have that book republished, and it'll be coming out either late this year or the first part of next year.
Oh, good.
But it's being republished with a new resource section and a new preface. So I'm really happy about that book. You know, if I may, I'd like to just sort of wiggle right in here right away and, you know, say a little bit about Future Memory because it's not a book. Yeah, I don't know if you've ever seen it, Lance, but if you haven't, you need to get it.
I will get it.
It looks like a book.
I want all your books now. One just came in yesterday.
It's literally a labyrinth. Every sentence, every paragraph, every page is part of the math I used to create the labyrinth format.
Wow.
So when you start reading it, you have to read it straight through. You can't skip around. You know, if you're walking a sight labyrinth, you don't go skipping it around. You stay on
the path. That's right.
Well, when you read a book labyrinth, you got to do the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's what Future Memory is. It's a book labyrinth.
Wow.
And, of course, the purpose of any labyrinth, they're healers.
Yeah.
And the reason they heal is because they bring you up to the next highest level possible for you in consciousness at that
time.
Right.
Yep.
So the book is really a psychotronic device.
Oh, I'm getting it.
It's alive. It'll work on you.
I had those experiences two-thirds of the way through this recent book. I was completely in the present moment, and I knew everything was okay. The past and the future already are, and that we've already lived this. And it was as clear as a bell. It was as if I was in another world. So,
no, it's as if you have slipped into the reality of this world.
Right. So... Now, you mentioned Danyon Brinkley having made famous the tunnel thing and many other things about his books. And he was struck by lightning three times, I think, three different times and had near-death. You have had three near-death experiences.
Yeah.
I was surprised when I got to your segment on lightning and the pre-strike that comes up and the strike that comes down, the communication that goes on and the new model it provides.
Well, if you really study that breakthrough moment of enlightenment, where the person is either moving up the Kundalini channel and going out to the top of the head, or if they are in that state where that energy can come maybe through the heart, maybe through the top of the head, and then go down. There are two different traditions of enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
There's what we call the Christos. That's the literal name. Some of us call it Christ or the Christed way. That's the tradition of Christianity, where it's coming from outside the self and moving in. If we look at the more oriental views or, you know, things like Kundalini, they're recognizing that energy beginning within the body, moving up through the body and going out. So there's two different directions of energy flow. That is what it is. It's two different directions of energy flow. And if you study that and what's going on, you can compare that to an actual lightning strike. And that's what I do in the book. You know, we call it enlightenment. Well, it's literally light. That energy, that sudden bolt of energy that changes the individual. And interestingly enough, in physical lightning, it happens because of the negative force from the earth meeting that positive energy coming from the sky. So that bolt is really not just a bolt, a strike of light coming down from above to the ground, but it's actually two different things. Mm-hmm, it's the energy on the ground coming up to meet the energy coming down from the sky. Well, always creates nutrients. Always creates nutrients. So the land is better and healthier because of the lightning. Well, it's the same thing in the human being. You can take a look at, you know, this is what I'm recognizing is not just one flow of energy, but that dual directional flow where you've got energy, we'll call it Kundalini, coming up the body. You've also got energy coming outside the body coming in. So you've got, again, that double flow up and down that's meeting in the middle. And when it does with the human being, it also creates those nutrients we call enlightenment that enables you then to do more, be more, become more intelligent. You know, it makes significant changes in the human being.
Well, they think differently, don't they? I mean, it's not actually thought. It's well, you have a whole list of different. it would be long to go into, but it's a whole different way of perceiving, and the IQ changes.
Those are just. Now, that's a significant feature of the near-death experience. That's a signature feature.
Okay.
That no matter how long you were dead, that is to say no vital signs, and the average is 5 to 20 minutes. That's average.
Yeah.
With no vital signs, no breath, no pulse, no brainwave function, nothing. Nothing's working, no heart that's beating. So the individual is as near as we can tell dead. That there's still a lot of activity, there's a lot of things going on. You know, scientifically, what they have found now, this is science, that they have found consistently that those people who are in this kind of state have very clear, detailed out-of-body experiences, clear, enhanced consciousness, self-identity with emotions, cognition, thought perception, full use of the faculties, and intact memories. Mm. All of this when the brain is not working.
Wow. And the longest you have in this book, I think, was about 4 days, wasn't it? Wasn't there one account
about... Well, that was 3 days. That was George Rodenaya. Yeah.
Oh, okay. No, that's not quite
that
so
was...
long.
Yeah, George
long enough.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Oh, the accounts are fascinating, too. I mean, in addition to your research and how you connect the dots, So,
yeah, I packed that book with as many accounts as I possibly could,
yeah,
both adults and children.
Oh, yeah.
You betcha.
Now, how does that tie into the idea of a soul quake, these near-death experiencers, and the ongoing learning and passing it on to the, not to their children, but to their children's children as the grandchildren? And how does you think that might tie into 2012 and the various cosmic cycles? Because you do mention the possibility of a cosmic awakening being akin to a earthly near-death experience for the whole planet.
Well, Ian, you know, we're having more and more and more of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
If you look worldwide, the conservative estimate for these kinds of cases is 4 to 5% of the general population. Well, we know through the science of fluid dynamics,
mm-hmm,
that it only takes 4 to 5% of any population, any condition, any occurrence. It only takes 4 to 5% of that to change, and automatically an entire group will change. So it only takes 4 to 5% of anything to affect the entire group, and the entire group then will change accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
So the tipping point that we're looking for, we now know, is 4 to 5%. We know that through fluid dynamics. But an interesting thing about fluid dynamics is that if the figure goes over that, then the energy becomes very excited.
Huh.
And if it becomes excited enough, you get what is called super fluidity. And when that happens, nothing can contain the energy. Nothing can contain it. So take a look here. 4 to 5% general population near-death experiences. That does not count near-death-like experiences. That does not count spiritual experiences. That does not count mystical experiences. You add those all together, and we've got a significant portion of the population worldwide,
uh-huh,
who are having transformative experiences.
Yeah.
So take a look at what that's doing. If we talk about the Arab Spring, which unfortunately is now seems to be coming an Arab Fall, but if you look at the original Arab Spring, it's not just Facebook that was enabling that to happen. These people were waking up. These people were clicking in and cluing in, and they were sounding like near-death experiencers.
Oh.
They wanted freedom. They wanted dignity. They wanted their rights. They were thinking of each other and other people. It became sort of like an every when, everybody,
uh-huh,
kind of situation.
Uh-huh.
It was taking off, and still is. So when you're looking at what a lot of people are talking about now, as per 2012, and, you know, we got to be honest here. We've just recently found another whole room full of the Mayan calendar that extends the calendar about forward about another 7,000 to 8,000 years.
Oh my
God! So is the Mayan calendar ending December 21, 2012? No, it's got about another 7,000 to 8,000 years to go.
Oh my goodness!
So if we're looking at that, what I remind people is that the real stuff that's going on is this huge shift. It's, you know, the changing of the cosmic year. And
yeah,
that only happens once every 25,920 years.
Right.
And it's happening now.
Yes.
So, you know, of course things are changing. And with that, more and more near-death experiences and other types of transformative experiences. Is the human family being, affected? Well, yes, big time.
Right.
On every level, just pick up your newspaper and read it.
Yeah.
Plus the human race, the human family is evolving.
Yeah.
You know, we were all told that, you know, we're going to have this cosmic shift or this quantum shift in the human race. Well, hey, folks, it's here.
Mm-hmm.
I've written a book about it. It's coming out this December. It's called Children of the Fifth World.
Ooh.
And I know for sure everybody's going to be amazed when they read that one.
Oh, well, you'll be back in December, I hope.
Well, that's up to you and your people if you want me back.
I do, I do.
You know, that sort of continues the story.
Well, of course. Now, talking about all the negatives, I'm simply framing it like that because this is how we perceive. People are going to jobs they don't like. They're running out of money. The banks are going out of business, and you know, things are taking over. There's a small group in control. There's wars and death and starvation. How does stress figure into the shift in consciousness and the near-death experience, and then, as well as chaos theory?
You ask such big questions, man. First of all, let's stop a minute and realize that what you are describing has been going on for decades and years and hundreds of years and eons of time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, when I was a kid, when I was about four and a half, we had Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yeah.
And there were people dying everywhere.
Yeah.
Your neighbors. You know,
and
everything was rationed. You couldn't go down and get a tank of gas. You couldn't even buy sugar. You couldn't even buy sheets for your bed. You had to have ration tickets. And if you didn't have them, you didn't get it. That's why people had Victory Gardens. That's the way they ate. Back in Twin Falls, Idaho, that's where I lived at the time, when I was walking to school.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, if someone in your family died in the war effort, you got a great big giant gold star decal you could put on your living room window.
Oh, well.
Well, most of the homes on my way to school had those big gold decals in the window. Well, I knew what they were. Yeah, I mean, kids know.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So I was walking the path of death to go to school, and this one morning, there were six new gold stars overnight in this one person's window, and I stood there, and I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I sobbed. Lance, I do not remember one single morning in all of my first grade where I didn't have to stop my shutters and cease my tears just to walk in the door of my classroom.
Wow.
So when you're talking about all the fearful things, I'm standing here, mm-hmm. and I'm telling you, the world has always had fearful things.
Yeah, yeah, that's
but
right.
What we have now are incredible breakthroughs that are telling us and showing us that there is another reality, another way to live, and that we can be innovators. We can find ways of making it happen, and we don't have to have everything fancy. We certainly didn't when I was a kid.
Right.
And we were very, very happy.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at some of the common traits of a near-death experiencer afterward. I'm just going to read this little list for you.
Oh, good.
Unusually empathetic, rich inner lives, some healing ability, complex, vivid dreams, good recall, highly perceptive, creative, intuitive, strong feelings, especially of love, faculties are enhanced, Phantasthesia, which is conjoined senses, psychic ability. Susceptible to environmental changes, more allergies than before. Sense of being able to merge with others and with nature. Surplus of energy for many, with others less. Restless, curious. Strong reactions to positive or negative sensory stimuli. Much in the way of visuals, aesthetic awareness and knowing. Intense focus. Love to question. Hunger for knowledge. Feel things deeply. Can have past life anomalous memories. Identify more with soul than self. Mystical awareness. Comfortable with things future and otherworldly states and beings. Can at times influence physical objects and move them. Electrical sensitivity. Out-of-body experiences can continue. Tend toward self-deception. Need to relearn basic cautions. Tend to identify life as a waking dream. And what I'm saying to everybody is, wake up, psychologists, wake up, psychiatrists. This is normal for millions of people.
Wow.
We have an event called the near-death experience that happens to millions upon millions upon millions of adults and children. It can happen to babies, to toddlers. It can happen to the wee ones in the womb. It can happen in the vagina during birth.
Wow.
It can happen at any time.
Wow.
And the little ones remember it. And when they're old enough to talk about it, they cry. You know, so some of their difficulties are with parents or relatives or who say, you know, that's just your imagination, or,
right,
you know, be quiet, or we don't want to hear about that, or label it in some manner and don't really listen to the kids.
Yeah.
We have, you know, I find it very interesting in the scientific era. We're having, you know, what some of us might call a mystical or a metaphysical or spiritual experience that is happening in medical surroundings that can be scientifically investigated. You know, we didn't have that 100 years ago or 200 years ago.
That's right.
Although we had a little bit of it, but not that much.
Rick Strassman is an example of that with the DMT molecule.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly part of, and may indeed be part of, the deeper structures of what's going on as far as the molecules are concerned. But I'm talking about an event, a condition, a phenomenon that is occurring that I find it interesting that it matches what is currently acceptable, you know, science. Well, here's something that is happening in conditions that can be measured scientifically. So, you know, isn't that fascinating that we're having more and more and more of them at a time when we have the science to look at them?
Yes, I see what you mean.
You know, make that connection.
Right.
It's like we're on course.
Yes, it does seem that way. And then science is merging or expanding to accept more of the unexplainable.
You know, they have to look at near-death experiences. To four prospective clinical studies that were done in three countries, the near-death experience is now the number one choice of scientists worldwide to study consciousness itself.
Did
you know, Lance, that we now know, and we know scientifically, that things like out-of-body experiences, otherworldly experiences, the dead come back, are all now considered normal and natural. They're now considered normal and natural to
wow.
the experience. They are no longer considered insane, or that you're crazy, or you made this up, or it's a dream, or it's a hallucination.
Right.
We can now prove none of that's true.
Wow.
That they are normal and natural to the experience.
Wow. And then you also chart out things that I had never heard of or read or knew about the brain, the limbic system, the frontal system, and the pineal gland, and how they all work together.
That's, yeah, and about the Akashic fields, you know,
oh.
and dark energy, dark matter.
Oh,
wait,
yeah.
You've got to look at all of this because it's all interrelated.
Yeah, yeah.
And, well, that's in the second half of the book. Let me
we're jumping ahead.
Let me share something kind of funny with you.
Okay.
And that is, the first half of the book really is near-death centered. Well, the whole book is. But the first half, I've got all kinds of compliments from, you know, thousands of people, best near-death research in the field. And then
oh,
chapter
yeah.
16
yeah.
changes the book.
Oh, yeah.
And chapter 16 says the key is intensity. It's not how many aspects or components occurred in the experience. Rather, it's how intense was it.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that's the key. That's where you have to stop and take a deep breath and say, wait a minute here, whoops, never thought of that. So the second half of the book delves into what that is and what that's saying, so that you're really taking a you're taking another look at all the deep structures.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking another look at how it's changing people.
Mm-hmm.
You're taking another look at the spiritual experience. What is the spiritual experience?
Yeah, yeah.
You're taking another look at what we call Christos or Christ,
right.
or a new Christology. You're taking another look at science. You have to take another look at all of it. And in doing so, then you're going to see all these things that are just really going to make you sit down and say, wow, I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but
mm-hmm.
but it's there. The links are there. You can trace it. It's just fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I get kind of excited about the book. I'm glad that now you are too.
But, oh yeah.
But let me tell you, all last year, the book came out in March last year.
Uh-huh.
From March to March, so from March 2011 to March 2012, this year. That book, Near-Death Experiences, Rest of the Story, had only sold 5,000 copies worldwide.
Wow.
And that's all.
Wow.
The kind of feedback I've been getting from people is, oh, they love the first half of the book, but the second half of the book, they're not interested.
Oh, my, the second half just...
The second half, I think, is the best part.
it's amazing. I mean, it's like a pinball machine. You're just going back and boom, 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 boom. And
everything is footnoted. I mean, you know, back up everything.
Oh, yeah. Now, so what about the colloidal condition? That was startling information.
Well, you know, if we're looking at transformations of consciousness, no matter how caused, then, again, I think we need to be honest with ourselves, because we've got all these traditions, we've got all these rituals, we've got all these religions, we've got all kinds of different ways of looking at the renewing of your mind or the transformation or transfiguration of the body. We've got all these legends, we've got all these rituals. You can cut through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And look at what's really happening. They are all transformations of consciousness, no matter how caused, are
mm-hmm.
threshold experiences. All of them. That's
mm-hmm.
the one word you can use. Doesn't matter what country you're in. Doesn't matter what religion you're talking about. Doesn't matter if you're channeling. The one word you can use is a threshold experience.
Mm-hmm.
They're all threshold experiences. A threshold experience is a sudden, intense experience that takes you to, of course, the threshold. That threshold between sanity and insanity,
mm-hmm.
between life and death, between light and dark. It's that core experience, the rawness of that core experience. Now, many times you can be greeted. Many times there's a guardian at the gate. You know, all these stories about the gate and the initiations and all this stuff. The guardian at the gate is always somehow symbolic of fear. So you're meeting that fear. You're meeting that ultimate crisis, that mm-hmm. ultimate moment, mm-hmm. and you're there. Another way you can look at it is think in terms of being at the tippy top of a very steep high mountain. You're way up there. You're at the tippy top. And you think you've got it. You think you're there at that transformational moment. The mystical moment. You know, you're there. And some fool comes along in back of you and pushes you off the peak. And you know, there you are in thin air.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you know or who you know. All of that is gone. Nobody can help you. You're there flowing and floundering in thin air, and the only thing you can do is either fall and break every bone in your body and be oblivion, or you can surrender. And if you surrender, that's when you fly.
Wow.
And you always fly into the same world. Described differently, it's the same world. It's called oneness. We, in modern days, call it the perennial philosophy, but it's one God, one people, one family, one existence, one law, which is love, one commandment, which is service, one solution to all problems, which is forgiveness. You flow into oneness. The Egyptians gave us a wonderful drawing that depicts this. I forget the name of the god or the goddess that is holding the scales. And, you know, one of the scales has a heart, the other one a feather. And the idea of the heart, if you're still self-centered, if you're still, you know, kind of me first, then your heart is heavy and it will kind of sink kind of low on that balance, and that means that you really haven't reached that point yet in your life where you truly understand what life is all about. So you're sort of condemned to the netherworlds, or you have to do it again, or things will be harder for you. But if you have reached that point of selfless service, where you really understand more about who you are and what life really is, then the heart weighs less than the feather, and you're freed. So it's this same kind of thought of the threshold experience and whether or not you surrender. You know, and we find this again and again and again in near-death research. If the experiencer during the experience surrenders to the experience, mm-hmm. inevitably, they will have a deeper and more complex experience. It's that, again, it's that idea of surrender. So we get to that moment where we give up. Not just give up, but surrender and just sort of
move
into the experience.
Yeah.
And when we do that, invariably, it becomes a more enlightening or positive experience. But, you know, I don't care how how enlightening or hellish these experiences are. It's always the after effects, how you deal with them, and what happens in your life afterward, and how you're able to handle it.
Absolutely. You know, I found it interesting that some of the people who had had just amazingly glowing, almost heavenly types of experiences that they were describing and wonderful transformations were, some of them were very angry about it and pissed off. And other people who had had negative ones said that it had changed their life more than anything.
Well, you know, I really like to talk about that. One experience I had that just so graphically illustrates this, and it was a senior center, and it was open to the public, so it was filled to capacity, and people were standing. And I was giving a talk on my research, and at the end of my talk, I did what I often used to do in the good old days. And that is, I would ask the audience, you know, is there anybody here who would like to come up to the microphone and talk about or describe their near-death experience? You know, anybody who not done it before, would you like to take advantage of this opportunity? Well, two people volunteered, a man and a woman. And the man was first. And I guess his age, I suppose maybe early 30s. Middle 30s, maybe. I'm not quite sure how old he was, but about that. Nice-looking young man. And he described his experience, and there wasn't a dry eye in the place, I'll tell you. It was so beautiful,
wow.
And it was so wonderful. It was one of these really heavenly experiences. And when he was through, he shocked everybody in the audience by saying this was the worst thing that ever happened to him in his life. He felt cursed to have had this. He wished it had never happened. It had destroyed his life, and he was very upset about ever having had an experience like this. And then the woman jumped up. I mean, she didn't even wait to go to the mic. She just jumped up. I tell you, Lance, she was glowing. She was absolutely glowing.
Wow.
And she started describing her experience. It was one of these hellish ones where, you know, it was really dark and there was this big storm and lots of thunder and this horrible wind. And and she was in a whirlpool. And she was being sucked down in this whirlpool. You know, and she had to fight to get out of the whirlpool and get to the shore and save herself. And again, she shocked everybody by saying this is the best thing that ever happened to her. You know, and it proved to her and it showed to her that everybody has a second chance. We always have another chance. We are never defeated. Absolutely never defeated. We always have another chance.
Wow.
And she said it was the best thing that ever happened to her. So, you can't just automatically judge. You know, you have to get rid of words like positive and negative because they really don't apply.
Right.
And what I'm finding out more and more and more are these cases that are so incredibly positive. And even some of them, people come out with, you know, best-selling books about their case and you know, have all the after effects afterward.
Mm-hmm.
But do very strange things with their lives. Just found out about one that happened in the 20s. I don't have all the details in front of me right now, where the guy wrote this book and it became very, very famous. He became very famous and, you know, sort of like modern times. And then during the build-up toward World War II, he took the side of Hitler and did everything he could to support Hitler.
Wow.
He felt Hitler was right.
Wow.
And, you know, in the book, I talk about, you know, this experience in Africa and then the historical experience in China where you're having several different types of episodes like this, where you have experiencers that seem to be using their experience in a very positive way, and it turns out to be negative.
Huh.
Or what we could call negative in the sense of destructive.
Okay, all right.
So, you know, it's a real caution. Remember when I was reading off that list of common traits afterward, tend toward self-deception.
Ah.
That is very real.
Ah.
And what I tell a lot of near-death experiences is, please, please, please get in a psychic development class, especially one that teaches self-defense, and learn what the traps and the tricks are.
Oh, right.
Because you can fall on your face.
Oh, yes.
This one woman, near-death experiencer, who came back, absolutely glowing and very transformed, and she's getting guidance afterward, and it's very specific and to the point, and her guidance is telling her to have snakes tattooed on her arm.
Okay.
And she did.
Oh.
And she's supposed to be this great healer.
Huh.
And I'm looking at that, and I'm saying, now, wait a minute here. That doesn't sound like a very high or uplifting or healing type of energy to me.
No,
that sounds
sound
like self-deception.
Yes, it does, indeed.
And just because you're knowing things and seeing things and getting visions and hearing voices doesn't mean it's correct, doesn't mean it's helpful.
That's right.
Doesn't mean that it's what you think it means.
Exactly. That's right.
So, you know, we need time to integrate this, and even during that time, it really helps to do some reading or get in some classes or do some real depth work. Just having the experience is not enough, I do not think. I think you need some more help afterward and sorting it out and being able to handle it, especially being able to handle it.
That makes sense to me. That sounds like very good advice. I really like the chapter 17. Well, I like all of them, but this one is on the brain shift, sensitivity, and synchronicity.
Well, that becomes... daily afterward, you know, synchronicity becomes part of your daily life.
Yes. Yeah.
It's almost as if you get into a flow.
Uh-huh.
You know, and the life begins to flow.
Yes.
And things just meet when they should or could.
Yeah.
And everything just flows. And you just turn around and your needs are there. It's just like... Well, let me give you a real recent one. My husband 3 weeks ago had emergency spinal surgery, and we were, you're just very held by this because it's an emergency, it's major surgery, and it's, you know, it's just like pow, it's like being hit in the face. There were no warning signs, there were no signals, and here we are in the hospital, and they recommend this great surgeon, and it takes 6 to 8 weeks to seem, and the next morning I was on the phone right away, and just before I called, another patient called in and canceled their appointment, so we got right in instead of 6 to 8 weeks, and more x-rays and stuff, and the doctor said, well, I just happened to have some open time tomorrow morning. We took it. In 3 days, it was all over.
Wow.
And now, after 3 weeks, he's now able to drive and he's starting to walk a little bit. So,
good.
You know, synchronicity just becomes part of your life.
Yes.
Things just open up in as part of a flow state.
Flow, yeah. Yeah, I've had fairly long periods of intense synchronicity, and I use synchronicity as kind of a guiding light as to how awake I am. If it's not happening and I don't notice it, then I start thinking about it and remembering that that's how it works, and I don't have to think about it. So it's as if there's some kind of continuum in above and below, to the right, left, and so on and so forth, that just is constantly making adjustments from various sides, whether it's past, parallels, or other dimensions. I don't know.
Yeah, but everything is constantly shifting.
Yeah, and yet it's all in the now at the same time.
There's no one way that
anything
happens. It's always shifting.
Right, it's amazing. Well, you know, we've only got 5 minutes left, and I have all these other questions for you, too, but I want you to be able to tell people about your website and how to get your book, which I'm going to say right now, everyone should get this book. It is a standard. It's the best book on this subject and on consciousness changing and on the shift and on, I mean, it is outstanding. I can't say enough good things about it. This is a must-have, and I read a lot of books for this show, and I don't think it was any accident that I just happened to listen to our show from about 4 years ago, and I just loved listening to you, and I thought, I told her I'd have her back. I'm going to contact her, and here we are talking now.
Well, so, you can get that book at any bookstore.
Right.
They don't have it. They can order it for you. You can get it on Amazon.com.
Mm.
You can get it on my website. If you want an autographed copy, then you want to get onto my website.
Mm.
My website is just myname.com. So it's www.p, P as in Paul, M as in Mary, H as in Howard, Atwater, just at and then water. So it's pmhatwater.com.
Mm.
And while you're there, subscribe to my free monthly newsletter. It's always, you know, it tends to be different types of subjects. You never know, because I never know what I'm going to be inspired to write about. There's an archive there, and you can check out past issues, and especially get on the ones last year on electrical sensitivity, and again this year on electrical sensitivity. Been talking a lot about that and how experiencers like you and me are affected during storms.
Oh, yes, yes.
Because there's an electrical component to a lot of storms.
Yep.
Tornadoes, earthquakes. Most people don't realize there's an electrical component to earthquakes.
Oh.
So I'm not just talking about lightning here. I'm talking about a much vaster subject than that, and it affects us all directly.
Wow. Well, PMH, I have another of your books that I want to read. It's on the Newt Kids. I got that before I had received the one on this, on the near-death experiences, The Rest of the Story, which is the one we've been talking about tonight. And I hope that you will be able to come back before December and chat with me again about the other findings that you're making. I mean, you are the cutting edge. I mean, this book is just beyond anything I've ever seen. And so I just want to thank you for putting yourself out there and doing this amazing research and sharing it with the world. It's really quite
that's my job. That's my job, and I thank you very much, Lance, for your compliments,
okay.
But that's my job.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
what I was told to do in my third near-death experience,
wow.
And so it's what I do.
Were you given any time frame as to, okay.
No, not time frame, just do the job.
Okay, well, I hope you don't get it done soon. So I can have you back in a few months and in December.
Sure.
Thank you so much, PMH. I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Absolutely. Just give me a call.
All righty. All right. Good night, everybody. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.